Hello and welcome to El Telejon's La Liga Weekly. There is no La Liga, of course, but we're still here because, well, why not? I'm in South Oxfordshire. Terry is in a secret location on the Hertfordshire-Essex border. Most importantly, Terry, how are you?
I'm fine, John. Yep, all very good. Been spending, I think it's 10 days now, we're barely seeing anybody. Popped into the supermarket to get essentials, only essentials, nothing that we don't need. And just been basically going for 3 or 4 mile walks every other day at least, just to get some fresh air. Then not seeing family, not seeing anybody else. But I'm amazed at how many other people. I drove yesterday to drop some essential shopping to my daughter, who's recently had a baby. And just amazed at the amount of people that are out and about, and cramming coffee shops and pubs and restaurants. So I don't know if it's just me that's being a little bit panicky, but I feel it's the best way for us all to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, no, there's a real split, isn't there? I mean, it's been reflected with the sort of national policy as well, hasn't it, where they've sort of done a flip, haven't they, from a very laid-back start to a much tighter regime now. I think the message from people in Spain, where they are further ahead than we are with the virus, is they're all saying they wish they'd done it earlier. And more restrictions earlier in the piece, just because of the overwhelming effect it can have on your health service. And obviously, you know, it's a really serious situation, isn't it? But we're basically going to talk football because we're both sitting in our houses, so we might as well have a conversation, and you might as well all listen to it, because presumably lots of people are sitting around not doing an awful lot. So good luck, you know, keep yourself safe. I mean, and you've got a lot of sympathy for anyone self-employed in you know, precarious jobs, rented accommodation, that kind of stuff. You know, it's some tough times. So we've got to look after each other, haven't we? So onto the football. I don't propose that we have a long conversation about the coronavirus and football, because I think it just depends what happens, doesn't it? The obvious priority is to keep everyone fit and well, as many people as possible fit and well. The football will take care of itself when it happens. If I had a view, it's that you should finish this season, if at all possible, because this one's started. I know people like to sort of wind up Liverpool fans and talk about the season being null and void, but I think if at all possible, you play the remaining 10, 12 games of this season. I think UEFA have done the right thing to postpone the Euros a year, and then we'll get on and worry about what we do with the next season, when we get to it. Do you have a different view from that, Terry?
No, I totally agree. I think the suspending of the European Championships postponement is ideal. I think the date that they're giving is June the 30th, I hope is going to be sufficient. Personally, I'm really positive that the situation is, I have no evidence, I have no knowledge. I'm just, you know, hopefully I'm a positive person. I'm hoping that the whole thing's going to, you know, be curtailed pretty soon. Probably goes against popular opinion, but I'm just looking on the bright side. And likewise with football, I think that June the 30th is a decent date for everybody to get their head around. It's not insurmountable. I read that the date can't be moved back, but I agree with you. I think at all costs, when I'm talking about all costs, I mean in terms of starting next season, if that has to be put back, then so be it. But I think this season is the priority to make sure it's finished throughout the world of football.
So then I started there wondering what to talk about. What we can do is if we get together in a few days or next week or something, we'll take some questions. But I thought we could have a chat about the slightly wider state of football in Spain, around the rest of Europe and the world. And my view, well, I wanted to get your view on the relative strength of the leagues at the moment, of the big clubs, of levels of innovation. And because I asked you, is there anything interesting happening tactically around football at the moment? And you couldn't think of anything off the top of your head.
No, I can't. And I think there are new cliches, new labels that analysts, pundits, people like ourselves that like to use to address football. But that's all what they are. The basic fundamentals in football remain exactly the same as they were. The laws of the game have changed. The facilities that the players, the conditions that the players play the game now have changed, which benefit them. I'm talking about the wonderful pitches, the better footballs, the laws of the game, which stopped the aggression that my career was alongside in terms of, you know, the tackle from behind and stuff like that. But I you know, when I hear people talking about these new tactics, they're the things that I did in the late 70s, 80s and 90s. You know, I was a striker. I closed down from the front. That's what it was called then. Now it's called a high press. But it was something I did, you know, 30 years ago. The low block is dropping deep, which is exactly, you know, what some teams did. But it's the fundamentals are still the same. As I say, the conditions that the players operate in now are far better. I think that's the biggest difference to me. And this sounds really strange. Coming from an old ex-professional footballer, the biggest difference I see now is that the players' salaries. And that's obvious. It's blatantly obvious. But what I mean is we lived the era that I played on a month-to-month basis waiting for payday. So now you can afford to have your own personal trainers. You can afford a more comfortable car if you've got a back problem. You're not sharing the driving with a teammate. You're not living great distances away from the place where you work because you can't afford to move house. And it's just basic things like that which lead to the players actually looking better physically, of course, coupled with the training and stuff. But, you know, we played as many games. We had a 22-team division. Liverpool, Aston Villa, Nottingham Forest were reigning supreme in Europe. Other clubs, you know, were winning. You know, Spurs were winning, you know, UEFA Cups, and Everton were winning Cup Winners' Cups. So I think in general terms, I don't think personally, and I occasionally watch, you know, some of these old big match reruns. And because I'm like everybody else, starved of any live sport and football at the moment, I watched a couple at the weekend. And I was really pleasantly surprised. One of the games was from the 70s, Manchester City Leeds. Some of the skills, some of the players, Rodney Marsh, Johnny Giles, Alan Clark, people like that, Dennis Stewart. It was exactly matched the level now, but also they were trying to practically break their leg every time they got the ball. Aston Villa, I saw, you know, Gary Shaw. That people listening to the podcast won't probably be aware of Gary Shaw. I hope a lot of people are. What a talented player he was. The skill level he showed. The Aston Villa team that won the European Cup with Dennis Mortimer and Tony Morley and players like that. The quality on show was incredible. And that was against Watford, who were one of the most, you know, a more direct team, an aggressive team, hard-working team. But the skill level shown by those players under, you know, in desperate pressure from the opponents. We have a different law book where fierce tackles were allowed. Was astonishing. One of the games was a cup match that I played in, Everton against Spurs. And I winced at one of the tackles on me. Because it was a horrible tackle, a clear red card in today's climate, and it wasn't even a free kick. and I ended up with shredded Achilles tendons, which, you know, still give me issues now. And this tackle, I got one of those a game, and it's that tackle that caused my Achilles tendons to be shredded. So it's over the years that the laws have benefited the more skillful players, which I'm more than happy with. But in general, the fundamentals of what we saw, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, I hope so, the Atletico Madrid performance against Liverpool. The fundamentals from Atletico Madrid are exactly the same fundamentals that Simeone went through. The whole process when he was a player. If the quick throw out from the goalkeeper is on, do it. If it's not, get your team shape. The amount of work you have to do, the amount of ground you have to cover. You know, the covering in defence situations, the blocking of crosses, the blocking of shots, the fundamentals with a goalkeeper for Simeone are a lot different to other players, to other clubs. His biggest fundamental with the goalkeeper is he has to be a bloody good goalkeeper, first and foremost. You know, that's what he's interested in. He's not interested in whether he can play the ball with both feet. He's not interested if he can play a 60-yard pass. It's first and foremost, the most important thing with Simeone and Atletico Madrid and Jan Oblak is probably the best goalkeeper in the world without having the ability of some of the others that play at the back. So football, it's 11-v-11. It's you get hopefully teams playing different tactics, some push on, some drop off. Some like to play at the back, some are direct. And I love the fact that we have teams, I mean, in La Liga as well, especially at this moment, teams that are different, that play different styles, that give opponents, you know, a different problem to solve. The difference in my era was every game was 4-4-2. And you had a direct opponent, two strikers played against the two centre-backs, the two central midfield players played against each other, the wide midfielders or the wingers and the full-backs up and down in straight lines that played against each other. So there was that personal combat that went on a weekly basis. If you could get the better of your opponent, then, you know, more likely than not, you won the game. So we didn't have the issue of, I played 15 years. I came against one team that changed to a three at the back, and that was Queen's Park Rangers when they tried to combat Wimbledon's direct 4-4-2 approach. That meant they had an extra central defender to, A, cope in the air, but it was Paul Parker, who was small anyway, and to cope with channel balls. So all we did after 10 minutes when we realised what was happening was hit diagonal crosses, diagonal long passes, instead of hitting the channel ball. A channel ball is just straight down the wing for the forwards to chase. We did diagonals, so it went from right to left or left to right, and we used big wingers against the small wingbacks. That's so we overcome that pretty quickly. So, you know, it's that's the big difference. More teams operate with different tactical systems now, but fundamentally, it's by and large 11v11.
Can we wind the clock back, what, maybe a decade, and just have a think about the big change with, or tell me if it was a big change, with Barcelona, Spain, Aragonés initially into Del Bosque, with Xavi, Iniesta. So was that a fundamental change? Did that, has that had, because certainly in terms of how FAs coach, because I watch a lot of kids' football, and Every team, whether they're equipped to do it or not, they've got a coach who's going through his coaching badges, are playing the ball through the penalty area, literally sideways to the penalty area. And sometimes on muddy pitches they're doing it, because obviously it's England and we have muddy pitches. So that did seem to change the coaching setup. So was, how fundamental a change was that, looking back? Or was that a more practical thing of some good coaches with a set of good players, and they thought, you know, these tactics will suit this set of players in this era. So how fundamental a change was that period of Guardiola at Barcelona?
And Aragonés with the Spain team as well, because I was coach of Northern Ireland when we beat Spain 3-2. At that time, it was a turning point for Spanish football. Aragonés was going to get the sack. Do you remember David Healy got a hat-trick? We beat them 3-2 at Northern Ireland. We had a direct approach with Northern Ireland. We, you know, a large partnership up front, hard-working wingers, hard-working midfield players, making sure, you know, players won their tackles. When we played Spain that night, they didn't have a style. They had a group of outstanding players, but they didn't have a style. So when we played them that night, we weren't aware of this, what was going to happen in the future with Spain and what was going to happen in the future with Pep taking over at Barcelona. I think Iniesta was on the bench, but by and large, you're looking at a team that, you know, was Raul up front, Fernando Torres, David Villa. It was a team full of outstanding players, but not a style. And I think that was a turning point for Spain. After that, Raul never played again. Other players were jettisoned from the squad, and Aragonés went with that new approach, which was just, it's common sense. When you've got, at that time, Busquets wasn't involved, but when you've got Busquets just around the corner and you've got Xavi and Iniesta, you've got the perfect made midfield three. And the same with Pep. You know, I'm sure he had an idea that he wanted to implement, but he couldn't implement that if he didn't have Xavi, if he didn't have Iniesta. You know, if he didn't have Pedro up and down and flying around on the wing, and of course, the one player I forgot, Messi. So good players help. A good manager will adapt to what he has at his disposal. And I think that's that. What you're saying there, I agree with that. That was back in, we're talking 12, 13 years ago now when that started. And people are still trying to implement that is the only way to play football. And I don't think it is. I think it's a great way to play if you've got the players that suit that style best. If it's not, then you have to find your own route, your own path, your own style. But I think that was, you know, and we saw the success of Spain, we saw the success of Barcelona, and people are still trying to emulate that. I don't know what the listeners feel. Is there anything worse in football when the goalkeeper has a goal kick and he's searching and players are around the edge of the penalty area and you just know what's going to happen next? You just know that when they play that short goal kick, the other team are going to close them down. They're going to force them into eventually kicking the ball away long and it not getting anywhere. Occasionally it works. You get out to the halfway line. Then there might be a benefit. Not often. And you won't see Simeone's team. You won't see Oblak put the ball down on the six-yard box and look for Stefan Savic on the penalty spot, or Felipe, Kieran Trippier playing along the byline, and then them trying to work it out into midfield and then build it up slowly and lose the ball after six or seven passes and be under immediate pressure. It's down as, you know, I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think it looks, to my opinion, it looks awful when the goalkeeper's desperate. And you know, at the back of his head, he's thinking, I don't really want to do this. I want to get the ball into the attacking half. I don't want to be under pressure in 10, 15, 20 seconds time from a mistake from a teammate. So I think it's, as I said, the fundamentals. I love it when a goalkeeper comes out, catches across, looks up, a player's in space and he throws the ball out and they can work the ball up the pitch quickly with possession. I'm not saying for one moment that every goalkeeper should get the ball, catch it, get the team set up, kick it to the halfway line at the very least, you know, put it in into an area where you call the mixer, where it gets knocked up in the air and you fight for the second ball. But I think it's just about doing the right thing at the right time. But I think in England, when I went to Spain in 2004, everybody was playing 4-3-2-1 or 4-2-3-1, one of those two. It was, and Rafa Benitez was the only one playing it in England with Liverpool. And then everybody started copying. And I still think there's an element of that where, you know, whereas in Spain, we've seen it evolve into more teams copying Simeone's team, for instance. You know, managers realised that in order for them to be in employment, their teams had to do well. The one of the safer ways was to emulate Simeone's 4-4-2 and have the same attributes, you know, the same fundamentals. And I personally think it makes a better league, whereas I think there was a period in Spain where everybody was playing, like I played 4-4-2 every week, against 4-4-2 every week. Everybody was playing a similar style with the 4-2-3-1 or the 4, you know, it was samey. Whereas now I think we get the, you know, different attributes. Athletic Bilbao were the only team when I was living there for 4 years that played a direct approach. Now there's a number of teams that do it well. Getafe, of course, with their budget, are the obvious ones example to use in terms of, you know, the 4-4-2 approach. Espanyol did it last season, and Abelardo has had a change of heart over his success as manager of Alaves, where he played 4-4-2, not doing so well at the moment, but he's leaned away from it at Espanyol. He's not playing it. He's playing Raúl de Tomás up front on his own. So I think there are, you know, it's making the most of the players you have at your disposal rather than you trying to fix as a coach an idea amongst your players that doesn't fit, you know, their you know, the style of players that you have.
So Quique Setién, Terry, at Barcelona, where are they heading? What do you expect from him tactically? It's obviously early days, so it's harsh to draw any big conclusions, but we've seen him in the past, haven't we? We've seen him in action with various levels of success. So where's the immediate future for Barcelona in terms of him and his tactics?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with his tactics. I think his tactics, his style he wants to implement to his players are the right tactics. It's the technique that I think is lacking at the moment. And by that, I mean, I don't think they move the ball quick enough. They don't move it accurate enough. But I certainly wouldn't suggest for one moment that Ter Stegen gives up playing the ball out the back and that he goes direct. That wouldn't suit Barcelona because of the players that they have. Who are they going to be, you know, hammering the ball forward to and hope that Messi, you know, gets on knockdowns or flick-ons? That clearly isn't going to work. See, he has the players. Whether they're good enough or not, it remains to be seen. But I would like to feel that, you know, when you look at the Barcelona midfield players, Rakitic is a good example of a technically good player. But then you have Artur, De Jong, Busquets. That should be sufficient. I think Vidal gives the ball away too much, but he gives them something different in terms of his aggression. Then you're looking around, obviously, at the top end of the pitch with players missing through injury doesn't help Kike Setien. But I don't think he's a million miles away from, I wouldn't say getting it right, but I don't think he's a million miles away from having the right ideas. I just think the players need to implement them better to make sure they realise the importance of keeping the ball, you know, but they don't. I think too many of them see it, are too casual in their approach to possession football, too slow. So they're quite easy things for him to correct. So, you know, seeing as he's been around for a while, and I think we all believe he's a good coach, then hopefully, given time, and I'm not talking about next season and the season after, I'm talking this season, you know, he can get those ideas across better and his players implement them far better than what we've seen so far. Because, as I say, they give the ball away far too much. They're not very good at chasing and winning it back when teams hit them quickly on the break, when there's a turnover in possession. And it leads to PK, Longley and Umtiti chucking themselves around, too many last-ditch tackles, relying on Ter Stegen to make saves. So I think there's room for improvement from Barcelona with the players they have, but they need to be made aware of the importance of the fundamentals that Barcelona have.
Now, what about Real Madrid and tactics? He's a pragmatist, Zinedine Zidane, isn't he? He's from very much the sort of the Ancelotti school, if you're prepared to give Ancelotti a school. Do you ever remember a Real Madrid era that wasn't all about being pragmatic? I think even back in the day, even back to the success of the 60s when they won the first five European Cups, it was basically a very expensively assembled team of the best players they could possibly get their hands on, and they tried to sign all the best players. They got Di Stefano and Puskas and Hendo and all of that great team, and they put them together and they let them go. And is that okay for Real Madrid? Do they have to do anything tactically innovative, or is it just buy the best players, work hard, get a system that's fairly straightforward?
I think that's exactly right. I think that is the case. You think back to the Galacticos. I had the pleasure of being out there and going to watch them on every occasion I could. So 4 years, I probably saw them 15 times, maybe more, 20 times. And I was amazed that Guti was the defensive midfield player, a player that hasn't got a defensive bone in his body. But when he had a midfield alongside him of Zidane, Figo and Beckham, he was going to be, you know, the holding midfield player. It just didn't work from a point of, you know, view of the fact that, you know, they didn't win the trophies they should have done when you chuck in Ronaldo and Michael Owen up front, and players like that and Raul. It didn't work because we all know that, you know, it was a classic Real Madrid tactic of buying the Galacticos and hoping that five or six of them, Roberto Carlos flying up and down the wing, would be enough to, you know, to make a team. So it is a team, essentially a team game. But I think, you know, by and large, Real Madrid do get it right if you continue to buy the best players in the world. The difference is that they're not the only club able to do it anymore. So competition to buy those players is much tougher because of the money, the finances that other clubs have. Whereas in the past, it was Real Madrid, Barcelona. They could blow anybody out of the water. They were taking the best players from, you know, from Juventus and Manchester United. And there was always an attraction to go and play for Real Madrid. But of course, they had to have the finance to back it up. And they did. They were one of the few clubs that could do it. So I think with Zidane, I don't think his approach is drastically wrong. There are issues. I think that if you want to look at each of his seasons, where the squad has been light in certain positions, that still remains. There's no cover for Casemiro, no obvious cover for Casemiro, which is going to be a problem. But then you look at the position regarding, say, the fullback, the right back. Carvajal is the nailed on one, but they've got Ashraf Hakimi and Odriozola out on loan. There's no obvious cover, so Nacho is the one that's going to have to cover some of the positions in the defence. They probably haven't sold enough players to have a turnaround that Zidane would have liked to have done. It's clear he doesn't particularly want James Rodriguez there and Gareth Bale. So I think there are issues. He doesn't give enough chances to other centre forwards at the club. Mariano Diaz and Luka Jovic haven't had opportunities to you know, stake their claim to be, you know, a centre forward for Real Madrid. So there are issues, but by and large, I think that the same thing applies. Buy the best players you possibly can, And with Zidane, he has to, you know, come up with a style of play that suits the players he's got. Maybe he's a little bit less reluctant to. He does stick to his 4-3-3, if possible. He'll adapt to try and get his strongest 11 players into the starting lineup at the expense of a tactical style. But, they, you know, still Real Madrid, they're not the a vintage Real Madrid, but they're still a very good team with outstanding players and a number of world-class players. So, you know, it is difficult. And as I say, it's difficult, especially to move on players that as a manager like Zidane clearly doesn't fancy. You know, when there's a not a lot of clubs rushing around to take the likes of Gareth Bale and James Rodriguez for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, because you get, they're not the only ones, are they? But you get, when you pay this massive amount of money for a player, because there's quite a step change between the super rich clubs and the next level down, it's very hard for a super rich club to get rid of anybody because they've paid such ludicrous amounts of money for them. And so you've ended up with players on negative equity in a way, haven't you? Sort of unsellable players, which I think has probably always happened to some extent, but it's very much the case now, isn't it? I tell you what, sit tight, everybody, and we'll come back. We'll just have a quick chat about the state of the league, but have a listen to some adverts and we'll make about 50p each out of it. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. We obviously got no live football to talk about, but we're still going to be here. So next time, I'll put out a call on Twitter or the Facebook page, if I remember, sorry, to get us some questions in, and then we'll take your questions and have a chat. But I want to ask you about the state of the various leagues at the moment, Terry. Obviously, it'd be great if the Champions League finishes and, you know, we get a bit more of an indication. Not that that proves things necessarily, certainly not 1 year at a time. I think over 10 years it shows you which is the strongest league, or 5 years. Where are we heading with the leagues? Are they in a healthy place? Are they too uneven? Or is it just sort of lacking in a clear way to define this era at the moment?
Are we talking La Liga or across Europe? I guess.
La Liga, obviously, we've got a good depth of knowledge, and then the English League as well. But feel free to reference in with, I'm thinking, you know, Bayern,
Juventus,
Juve, that kind of thing. Yeah.
I think in general, I think there's no getting away from the fact the same teams are winning the trophies each season, and the same teams are competing in the later stages in the Champions League pretty regularly. Last season was a little bit different with the likes of Spurs and Ajax being involved. But in general, you can pick, you know, the same teams that you think, you know, if you're looking at the European, the Champions League, you're looking at the same competitors, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Liverpool, recent times, Juventus, Bayern Munich, Atletico Madrid have a go each year. So I think there is an element of, well, we're fortunate in England with the four divisions of professional football, and then the pyramid below. I think that's going to suffer in years to come. In Spain, they have two top divisions. We're seeing better teams come up from the second division now, where I think that the money is dripping down to that level, which it should do. There's no excuse if you've only got two professional leagues in your country as big as Spain, that the second division clubs shouldn't have, you know, better financial rewards and a better chance of staying up when they do eventually get promotion. So I think that's going to be a big help. But I think it's, you know, it's probably no different to it was 30, 40, 50 years ago that we're, you know, in Europe, by and large, you're still talking about the same teams that won leagues, that won European trophies. This isn't new. I mean, a Manchester City and a PSG are relatively new in terms of their finances, their wealth coming into play, and they're making, you know, a quick shortcut by chucking lots and lots of money at it to join the elite. But we're talking the same elite clubs from, you know, when I was a kid growing up watching football. So I don't think anything's changed on that front. And as regards to the Spanish league this season, I think it is more competitive. than what we've seen for a long, long time.
But yeah, so competitive in terms of teams taking points off Real Madrid and Barcelona, not yet. Unfortunately, that the second rank of teams are not providing enough challenge for the title this season, though.
No, and I think that's interesting, though, because I think more teams are taking points off the top two. The problem then is the likes of Sevilla, Real Sociedad, Getafe, Atletico, Valencia, Villarreal are all very similar in terms of standard. And I think they're taking points off each other, which is harming any of their chances to get to close to Barcelona and Real Madrid. So, you know, it's a competitive league. You know, I look at newly promoted Granada in ninth. They're a good team. Athletic in 10th. They're a good team. You know, Osasuna have shown, newly promoted team, with their style of play. They obviously had to overcome the loss of their star player, Chimi Avila. But they're a half-decent team. Betis beat Real Madrid in the last round of games. They're 12th. Levante are a decent watch. We've gone away in Spain from those games where we believed that, you know, it was a foregone conclusion. You know, games were kicking off. Barcelona were playing around Deportivo. It was going to be a thumping. You know, I was looking at players that I quite frankly looked at and thought, this team has no chance against this attack of Barcelona. And 99% of the time, we were proved right. And, you know, it wasn't even a competition for Barcelona and Real Madrid. But I think genuinely in this season, I hate to say it because it's a cliche that I hated being used to describe the Premier League. Oh, there's no easy games in this league. There are fewer easier games now for Barcelona and Real Madrid. Hence, you know, you look at the losses they've had. Real Madrid have lost at Mallorca. Barcelona, Levante have beaten both of them this season. So there are fewer easier games than there was 5 years ago in La Liga, and I'm grateful for that.
So in terms of looking to the future, looking sort of in the distant future rather than endless speculation about, you know, the medium-term future, is there a pressure to move towards some kind of Super League? Now, I don't want that, and I don't think I know a single person who wants a European Super League, but then I don't know a single person who wants a 24-team Euros or a 48-team World Cup, but they happen. And they happen because the people with the power and the vested interests in having bigger and bigger and richer competitions force them through. So are we in danger, can I put it that way, of having a European Super League?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but yes, I think that the clubs around Europe with the historically the elite clubs do have a power that the other clubs don't. I don't know anyone that wants it. I certainly don't want it. I would even like to see the European competitions clipped down from their current format. I think, you know, this period that we're going through might just wise a few people up in terms of, you know, the football calendar, how crammed it is, you know, and it only needs something like this to put it into chaos. So, I think that I have to be honest, I get a little bit bored of the group stages in the Champions League. They're pretty much a foregone conclusion. It goes through, you get the odd group one, you know, every now and then that might have three good teams in it, and it's a little bit exciting, but we see the games are repetitive. So therefore, I think when we're looking at the bigger picture and the European Super League, the games will be repetitive. And they, you know, you won't have that rivalry that's ingrained in domestic competition where people, you know, it's only those people involved know the importance of derby, you know, certain derby games or certain games with, you know, a rivalry that shouldn't exist but does. You know, like Brighton Crystal Palace, for instance. I know that they're not a million miles away from each other, but it's certainly not a derby, but the rivalry has...
Yeah, that's a weird one.
But it's grown over the years that we won't have that in terms of, you know, European football. Is there going to be, a grudge matches and rivalries that are going to take years and years and years to develop, and we will have that. I'm pretty sure if it does become a European Super League, there won't be any relegation and promotion. It'd be closed off because none of them will ever vote for. Well, they can't. Once they're in it, they can't go back to domestic leagues.
But the trouble with that, the nightmare situation. Let's say if you're Manchester United in the last, since Fergie left, you'd have finished bottom of that European Super League every season. because they're just not as good as the other teams at that sort of rarefied level of the game. And then you find it's miserable. It's miserable supporting a team that gets relegated. You know, as a fan of Middlesbrough, the seasons that we're going for promotion are so much more fun than the seasons when we're clinging on desperately against relegation. And it would be, you know, it would be a rude awakening, I think, for fans of some of the big clubs. What if Real Madrid, in their best form at the moment, what if they have a season of, how many teams are in a European Super League? 16? What if they finish 15th or something, Real Madrid? That's not the plan.
No, and I don't fear it should ever happen. I really don't. I think that the leagues, domestic leagues, I hope it doesn't happen in my lifetime. I'd find it a real turn-off. I love the format in terms of the domestic competitions, and then I love the format of, you know, then qualifying and going into play in Europe the following season. Does it need 20-odd games to win the Europa League? Of course it doesn't. That's so obvious. I mean, that competition is destroying teams in terms of they find it a fantastic achievement to qualify for it. Espanyol, the perfect example. Then the following season, they're chucking games away. They're playing their reserves against Wolves in the knockout stages. It's too much to cope for teams of that level that are not used to, and there's a lot of teams that are not used to playing in Europe, playing European football, because, you know, it drops down to sixth, seventh position. You can have an outstanding season. You can have a good little group of players that you keep together for 2 or 3 years that enable you, you know, as a club now and then to qualify for Europe. And then it's increasingly, it hampers your the following season. So I think the Europa League needs to have a good look at itself. Why have so many games? And likewise, the Champions League, as I said, it's only really in the last round. You know, the knockout stage is where people do get switched on again and take a greater interest in it, as opposed to, you know, the group stages, which are, you know, if you've got a team in it, you're watching the games. There might be some occasional good matchups, but most of them you think, I saw that last year. There needs to be a change to adapt to the fact that one complaint I think we all have is that there is too much football for, you know, the big clubs, and it needs to, perhaps that needs to change. But so I don't want the European Super League, not at all.
Yeah. That said, I need to earn some money, Terry, when we all get to back playing football again. So you learn, you know, when in our position, you suddenly think, I can see what the big clubs are doing, because they always want money and it is always the priority. If you're some American investor or some Qatari investor in a club, you're not particularly interested in you know, the traditions of the East Midlands derbies and stuff, are you? You're just making sure that you drag some money into your club. Which I can understand it, which is why, you know, the feeling of things being inevitable are there. Anyway, shall we leave it there for now? Not that I've got an awful lot to do, but we'll keep ourselves fresh like the big clubs in European football should. So we'll do it again soon, and we'll take some questions. So watch out on Twitter and tell your friends that we're here as well. One quick tip, if you ring your TV providers, which are very expensive, you ring and ask, and you say, actually, can I stop? They might well find that they'll give you a discount or just give it to you for free for a month or something, because it's in their interest and they're aware that they haven't got any football going on, just if you need to save yourself a little bit of money. Right, Terry, stay nice and safe, and good luck finding toilet roll when you need it next.
Is this moneysaving.com as well as now as the League of Weekly podcast?
yeah. Your money saving tips.
Thanks, John.
As long as they're football related. Right. Terry, we'll speak to you soon. And everybody else, thank you for listening.